session number 24731, Real One.
Mr. Yeah. Vic Emery, Real One. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Emery?
I was born in Bristol General Hospital, 1924, in Bristol, that is.
What was the actual date?
14th of January, 1924.
And could you tell us a bit about your family, your background?
I was the eldest of five. My father...
Tell us a bit about your dad.
Well, my father was in the boys' regiment in the Devonshire Young Soldiers in 1917. Then he was in the Devonshire Regiment and wounded in France in 1918. He came out the army, couldn't stand civil life, and joined the Welsh Guards. He was in the Welsh Guards and met my mother, who was a servant girl in London. She came from her screen in Sussex originally, but when she was 14, nothing in Sussex to work for there, so she went to service in London. She met my father while they were, and they got married. And I was the first child out of five. So that's how, then my father couldn't get, I understand that my father couldn't get, he wouldn't give him permission to get married then in the Guards. I was supposed to do with money and all that. If he got married, he had to come out. So he came out and they were married. Came to live in Bristol.
What did he do there for a living?
Well, he went then to work with my grandfather in Copper Pass, who was a lead smelters in Bemister, Bristol. So he went, my father. I can go back to how that came about if you want to. My great grandfather lived in Somerset, and he was a bit of a blacksmith, and he used to make knives for the butchers in that, in Bemister, Babbage's, in places like that, and he used to walk in from Chew Magna and sell his knives, which is about 4 or 5 miles, sell his knives and walk back home. But anyway, he got the blacksmith's job in Copper Passes in Mill Lane, which was in 1970s or something, 1870s or something like that, whenever it was, and he was a blacksmith. Anyway, he got doing some job in there, and the chap with a sledgehammer glass off, hit my great-grandfather in the stomach, and he died. So, the grandfather and his children and his mother all had to go into the workhouse at Long Ashton because there was no money, things like that. But when my grandfather got old enough, well, 13, he went working on a farm at Porter's Head, out the workhouse, but the farmer used to beat him with a stick, so he ran away from there. And then got a job in South Liberty Pit, which was just down over from Bemister Down, where I used to live. Got a job in there as a cage boy or whatever it was, 12-hour shifts underground, and he used to open the draft doors to let the drama corps come through, and he shut it, explosion, no. Business. Anyway, he went to sleep one day and the dram come down and smashed through the door, so he got the sack from there. But he got a job in Copper Passes. Anyway, I suppose the firm took him on because his... So he got a job in Copper Passes and got his family out of the workhouse to live with him somewhere in Bemister. Then my grandfather got married to my grandmother, who came from Willacombe in Devon. And my father was born in 1899, so that's the family history up to there. And then, as I say, he was wounded in the First World War, joined the Guards, came out the Guards, and did his nine years. Then when he finished his 9 years, he let me go back before that. I was the oldest, so I had two brothers and sister born after that, up to 1928 or something. But three of them died in about 7 weeks with meningitis in 1929. And it was put down, it was, so my mother and father said in later years, talking about it, that before the Second World War, we used to get a lot of, Indians and Sikhs and that come round door to door with suitcases selling, and the medical officer of health seemed to put it down that... They must have contracted off of Anyway, they all died. Many judges before the Second World War weren't much hope for you anyway. So they all died. Anyway, so that was me. I was lucky. Evidently, I'd had a cord or something, and they seemed to think that one thing counterbalanced, so I was the only one left. So they decided that perhaps I was the only child that we should have another one to sort of balance up. Anyway, my sister was born in 1932. Well, that was a bit of an 8 years difference. And she was a girl and I was a boy anyway, so it went from there. So, as I say, they lived with my grandparents up Windmill Hill, and then in 1927 they got a council house. Bristol is extended, and they built on Bedminster Down then, so they, I'm not going backwards and forwards, am I?
No, you're all right.
No. They got this house in, and that's where my two brothers and sister died, in Langford Road, Bedminster Down.
Well, anyway, did you have a comfortable upbringing once you'd settled down there?
Well, let's put it this way. My father was unemployed at the time because in the 30s, Ledmore wanted me to do a week on the labour and 2 weeks and things like that. And I always remember he used to write me, I had to go into Bristol, sign on and write me in the labour machine on the bar of his bike. And you could see kids then round the centre of Bristol running around with no shoes and socks on. Convict haircuts and beyond that, I was a bit better than that. I had shoes and socks, but at times when I still used to go down the pawn shop for my mother and pawn things when things got bad. And my father had several bad accidents in Capra Passes, got lead burns on his arms. One instance I'll tell you about there, he had a very bad arm, he was burnt, and it was a great big septic place, and he said couldn't afford the tram fare. There was no buses, so we had to walk down to the bottom of Bedminster, down about a mile, and catch the tram into the general hospital. For to go to the, we used to go every day to have it treated. Anyway, he was in a lot of pain. It was a great big place in his arm, about what if I remember as a kid when he the people come round. I think it must have been, I don't know, insurance people or something from Capra Passes and see how he was getting on. He was off work about 10 weeks for that anyway. And evidently they said to him, oh yes, and now you've got an all this, Mr. Well, here's £5. I just signed there to say, and he was that bad, he just signed anyway, that stopped him from getting it. That's all he got, £5, never got any more for that. And after that he was struggling, and he got, you know, he had a job to it. And anyway, that was one thing. But anyway, as Hitler got a bit more...
What about your education? Tell us a bit about that.
I say about my childhood. I had a better childhood in many ways what boys and girls can get now. You could roam across the fields, climb trees, go down the stream too and build a little dam there and paddle about and take a sack tent down and roast potatoes on a fire. Things you wouldn't let children do now because of the people that are about. So in that way, an excellent... I went to infant school at Bedminster Down. Junior school, Bedminster Down. Quite a good school, only normal school. I was reasonably well academically, even if I do say I'm not, I do say so myself, but I had good reports and I failed my 11 plus because I missed two, well, I missed two exams anyway. And I used to worry as well as a kid. I used to think, well, with the 11 plus. Anyway, so I went to Marshby Road, senior boys, which was girls upstairs, boys downstairs, 11 sus, and I went into four. They used to have a class, this one, not a class, a stream system there, 4A, 4B, 4C, and 4D. 4A was the top, 4B was the next. 4C was if you were more like, not so much mental, but more physical and things like that, and 4D, and they used to teach them, the 4Cs, and they used to teach them, well, we went from... The first year was fours, the next year was fives, and the last year when you left was sixes. So I went 4A, 4B, 4A, 5A, and 6A. They taught you geometry, woodworking, all things like that. But the lesser ones, they taught them allotments. They used to grow a lot of stuff in, which they used to use in the school for cooking for the school meals. But it was good, and I eventually got a monitor. Let me back up there. I used to walk to school, was about 3 miles each way, I suppose, and walk home again. Eventually, last year, I think they put buses on that take us in the winter, but not in the summer. So it was quite a good rugby school.
Did you play rugby?
No, I was more, Well, it wasn't good enough. I was a bit of a frail lad, I think, at one time. I had one or two serious illnesses as a young lad and things like that. But anyway, I didn't play. I used to like running. I was very keen on running. But I didn't cross country and things like that. And,
were you in the Boy Scouts or anything like that?
They used to have a youth club in at Bemisher Down. It was run by the church, so it used to do a bit of horizontal bars and things like that, and gave 3 physical training exhibitions. 1935, the Jubilee year, we gave an exhibition down the Bristol City Ground, or was that 38? And in 1938, we gave another PT exhibition. Vice versa. One was at the Noel Royal Ground Stadium, and the other one was down in Bristol. But we gave it, and I gave a couple of exhibitions, physical training at different Marywood School, which is not there now, in front of school governors and all things like that.
And you enjoyed PT?
I used to like PT, yeah, you know, a bit of the old horizontal bars and all that. And
you left school at 14?
I left at 14, yeah.
And what was your first job?
So I went, my first interview, I went, well, my mother said, you want to go to your father? My father, before I left school, my father took me to Capra Passes to interview with a few, as I say, jobs weren't all that easy to get then. It was all mostly butcher's boys, baker's boys, or riding around with a frame on the front with a basket in and things like that. My mother said, you want to go into clerical work, you're good at figures and things like that. So I went for an interview at the construction works. We used to make the chassis for the double-decker buses, the Bristol Omnibus, and I failed there. Well, I didn't get that job there. I went to Jones's, which is a big departmental store, which is now Debenhams in Bristol. Didn't get that. So I went, the third job I went to was St. Anne's Bore Mill, which was a subsidiary of the Imperial Tobacco Company. So I went there and had me interview, sat for a test with 2 boys from public school. Anyway, I passed the written test in sums and all, and they didn't. So I was interviewed by old Mr. Biggs. He was the chief clerk or something. So he said, let me look at your fingernails. So I like this. It's more like a medical inspection. Where's your father? Works at Capra Passes. Mr. Well, is he a manager or on the staff? I said, no, he's a furnace man. So that, he's a eyebrow shopper. But anyway, I got the job. So I started as the dog's body in the wages inquiry office for 10 shillings a week, less 4 pence, Tuppence National Health and Tuppence Unemployment. So it was 98 pence a week. My job was to go in at 8 o'clock in the morning and go around. It's a big, covered a vast area. I don't really know anything about cardboard making machines, but they're 100 yards long. So it's quite a bit. I was going and collect all the making sheets for the shift works. 6 machines, 3 shifts, so I'd have kept 80. Bring them back for the board meeting at 9 o'clock. And that night, finish at 4:45, but not me, his dog's body. I had to go with the chauffeur into town, the general post office, and take all the registered mail in and get the receipts. And he'd bring me back to the board mills, which was coming away from home. And I used to cycle home. It was get up about 6 o'clock at night. Another of my jobs was, as I say, do this, do that. Anyway, I had that job for about 6 weeks, I think, and I'll tell you my downfall. I had to learn the switchboard. That was another job. When Miss Payne, I always remember Miss Payne, she used to attract much attention from the older clerks. She used to sit there. I was too young at 14. It didn't. So I had to learn the switchboard, and when she went to lunch, I had to operate the switchboard, which was included with about 70 internal lines, 4 externals, and we had an indicator system with lights all around the mill. If the chief engineer was, they'd put his lights up, like red and orange, flick or something, he'd know he was wanted. So we had to run. Anyway, I had one afternoon's training on that, and I used to go and relieve her for lunch. Anyway, I was in there this particular day, and when number 20, I think number 23, that was the managing director, answered that line straight away. So he went on, yes, Mr. Bodenar, that was his name. Get me my home, my wife immediately. Yes, Mr. Bodenar. Anyway, plugged it in and rang his home number and got no answer. Well, during that time, there was a couple of external calls from Norway come out. I forgot all about telling him. So about 3/4 an hour later, managing director. Come on. Have you got, oh, no, Mr. Bradner, I couldn't get, why didn't you tell me? I said, sorry, sir, I've only got one pair of hands. Well, that's telling the managing director, that sort of cut my goose to start with. So well, and the phone went down with him, told me to get his number, try number again and let him know anyway. So a couple of days later, Mr. Mustard, who was the secretary at his office next door, I was told Mr. Mustard wants you down his office. So I go down, he's knocked on the door. Come in, boy, you knew who it was. So right, knocks on the dividing door and marches me in towards Mr. This is the boy, Mr. Bodner. What's your name, lad? Emery, sir. Yes. How long have you been? You know, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever it was. Yes, sir. All right. Marched out again and left. And about, they all knew I was going to get the push then. I didn't. I was too naive then at 14. So anyway, about 3 days later, I had to go down, wanted them to general office, big general office, clerks and typists sat down, all with big ears, listen what we're going to have. Mr. Mullet with his desk there, stood up there. Right, so lad, we decided you're not suitable for the job. You know, it doesn't really suit you, this. You can either finish at the end of the month or you can go out in the mill. Start in the mill. I thought, to put it crudely, I thought, sod this, I'll go out in the mill. Unemployment, as I say, even then was... So, they said, right, you'll work the month out and then you'll start on the Monday morning out in the mill anyway. But prior to that, this Mr. Mustard... as I say, you had to ring a bell and you had to run, no matter where it was, you had to run here, run there. So Mr. Mustard's bell goes, ding, the other two in the office, like, down there, so away I go, sort of a bit of a, almost a bit Scrooge days, like, you know, I go rushing, knocked on the door, come in. Yes, Mr. Mustard, I want a piece of sticky tape, about 9 inches long. I said, right, Mr. Mustard. So went back up the office. Mind though, I suppose I didn't ask him. So he gets a piece of sticky tape, about half inch, size of sellotape, rushes back down there, knocks on, come in, or goes in, you're Mr. Mustard, have you wet it? I said, oh no, sir, I haven't. He said, put your tongue out. I poked my tongue out, and he rubbed this piece of sticky paper up and down my tongue like that, screwed up in the bowl, slung his head and go get me a wet piece. And so I thought, well, I can't stand too much of that. I was pretty easy going, but I should have only kicked him on the leg eventually.
So you were quite pleased to get the sack,
were you? Well, I was...
not pleased.
It didn't suit me, that. So
what were you doing in the mill?
So I started on the Monday. That was 7 to 5:30. 48-hour week it was. 7 to 5:30, Monday and Tuesday. 5 o'clock on a Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, and 7 to 1 on a Saturday.
And what was your work? What were you actually doing?
And I was... Well, I was used to scrub the floors and... in the beating house where they used to beat all the pulp up and things like clean the brasses, scrub the stairs down with a bass broom, with a large, like a large area, I suppose, from here down to the end of the road, like into Willow Court. Anything was wanted, lots of new brushes over the stores, get new brushes. And in between that, I was breakfast boys also, which was entailed going round the beating house, the size house, the machine house, the slitters, and finding out what they wanted for breakfast. They had egg bacon, potato cake, sausage, egg and bacon, things like that. And I get their orders and I go across the canteen. It's about 8:15, which is about 150 yards away. I get about 16 and order these 16 and egg and bacon. And I have all my lists down. And I used to have a tray then, you know, the ordinary size tray. Get 3 plates on there with a lid on top, another 3, so it comes staggering. There was 2 other boys in 5 beating house and 6 doing exactly the same. It was to come back up the road, trying to not let one to slip out, and I had to bring them back and then take them all around. And go around at 9:30 and collect all the empty plates up again and the money and go back and pay. Then at nights or in the afternoon, they used to do a little canteen service like... meringue pie and things like that, or apple tart. I didn't used to do anything cut, but just so I used to get the order of that and take that round to them. Pay up then, and when I clocked at 5:30, those that wanted, the shippers that wanted cigarettes and papers, I had to go across the shop in my own time, get it and then deliver it. But there used to be, when I say I was doing this, well, actually I'd had a rise then, 6 months a week. It'd gone up to 10 and 6 months, so I was getting 10 and tuppence then for 48 hours.
So how long were you doing that for?
Well, until I was 16.
Until 1940.
Yeah, then...
Now, what about the outbreak of war? How did that affect you?
Well, when I was 16, I went on shift work then.
I'll come back to that.
Oh, yeah. Well, the outbreak of the war, I was on shift work when the war started. 1939. No, I was on day work when the war started, but then they started calling them up, and at 16, you had to go on shift work anyway.
What do you remember about the outbreak of war?
Well, I remember on a Sunday morning... Well, 1938, my father was in the TA anyway, after he finished his time in the on the reserve with the Guards, he joined the 6th Gloucesters, which was the infantry regiment, TA, and he used to go off to camp. Anyway, 1938 was called up when the Munich crisis was on, and then demobbed again. In 1939, he was called up, and they changed it then. They'd gone from infantry, I think, the government thought air raids and whatnot else were changing. He went to an ACAT, heavy ACAT regiment then. I forget what the name of the number. But anyway, he was stationed down not far from Porter's Head on a 3.7 ACAT battery. So he was called up just for the war. So I was on. I always remember a Sunday morning, the radio on, and Neville Chamberlain saying, "We are now at war. We have received no answers, and we know it will." That didn't mean anything to me, actually.
Didn't affect you?
Well,
you didn't think anything of it?
Well, no, mostly all about the First World War with my father and how lousy it was and what a terrible thing it was, you know. But as a boy, remember at school, where I went to school, we were taught to be patriotic then, you know. It was Empire Day for the Empire and all things like that, and we had the... You used to march to the cinema on Empire Day and see all the shows about the Empire, India and the Raj and whatnot else. So it was a bit more instilled into you. I think Britain was right and Germany was wrong, and, you know, the halo shone. And so it didn't mean a lot to me, not really. My father was in down there. So I used to cycle down on a Sunday, perhaps, because I didn't work Sundays. You couldn't work Sundays when you were 16. Down in, see him down there, and cycle home.
Now, what was this introduction of shift work?
You were 16, you automatically went onto a making machine then. That was part and parcel of the job as a wet end boy, which was looking after the wet end part of the making machine with the felts and everything. It was quite a responsible job, really, at 16, for 6 months farthing an hour. That was 25 shillings a week then for 48 hours. I used to work 6 to 2, 2 to 10 in nights. The only time I couldn't work was between 10 o'clock Saturday night and 10 o'clock Sunday night. That was law then, but you could work. The mill worked through the weekend, you could work up to 10 o'clock Saturday night, so do 8-hour shifts. And as I say, it was for 6 months fire an hour, but then it meant something. You sort of started strutting your stuff then because you was at the bottom of the ladder on a making machine. After the war, it became a man's job for about whatever the rate. Going right, because they paid well after the war, it came up. But then it was a boy's job, so I was on shift for it then. And then,
how did the war affect you? You know, the
it didn't really affect me in that much. I used to buy the War Illustrated. That started off in 1939, and I followed. And when I went in the service, my mother kept on it. But anyway, I used to read all about this in German parachutes and whatnot, you know, and all things, follow it all up. But the only thing that really struck me was the pictures, and it was, I think it was Bertha Wilmot down at Southampton Docks, and you see all the troops going on board the ship, and she was singing "Wish Me Luck as Well." Every time I hear that, I always think of that 1939 as a troop the VEF was going. But anyway, I was on shipwreck, and then Dunkirk came.
Tell me about that, sorry.
Well, Dunkirk came, you know, and it still didn't mean a lot to me, really. Norway had been invading. We lost a lot of our pulp then that the Bormans used to buy from Norway and Sweden because things like that. And it affected in much that they were closing part of the mill down. They never had the stuff to produce until they made alternative arrangements. And I got shifted around a bit, which I didn't like, because I went from one machine to the old mill, and the old mill was entirely different. So I applied to come back to the new. But machine man, who was the top dog, there was 6 men and a boy on a machine. The machine man was the top dog, both being in the First World War. One had been in the Royal Horse Artillery, and the other one had been in the infantry, and they used to talk about that, you know. And But me as a boy, I'd walk up and down in front of the machine looking after all that. But it didn't really affect. No, it's only Dunkirk came, you know, and I can't remember. I know I didn't think a lot about that. Sundays we used to go for walks all out the golf links in Long Ashton, and used to watch the troop trains coming back then, coming up from Plymouth and all that with the Red Cross, with the wounded and that arm. But still, a boy, 16, it didn't. So then we used to. Yeah, we had a. Oh, they delivered the Angels and Charter then.
Tell me about that.
Well, they did. My father came. Oh, well, my father came out of the army then in beginning of 1940, because the phony war was on, and he was about 44, I think, something like that.
He was too old.
Well, you know, I suppose he thought, like, get him out, he only wants the youngsters and all that. So he got. Discharged. So we went back to Capra Pass as the furnace man. He thought he was more valuable as a furnace man than what he was sitting on his behind down at Peel Not Far in the gun sort of business. So, but then Dunkirk came and he joined the Home Guard, come out LDV, so he joined the LDV.
Hey, no, you keep going back and forth.
Yeah.
Anderson Shelters. Got to keep going forward.
So they dug that in down the bottom of the guard. Some had to pay, I gather, but we didn't have to pay. And they partly dug it in. And
how did they dig it in? Could you remember how you installed it?
They come round one day. I come home from work, and there was a big hole in the garden, you know, whatever the size was, and there was all the bits out. And they fitted it all up and just filled it in, left it uncovered at the top. So I was a bit keen then.
What was it like in there? Did you?
I made duck boards to go in the bottom. One of my pals worked for the corporation as a gardener, and he knew all about drainage and things like that. So you want a bigger sump hole. So we dug the sump hole, filled it in with bricks and all that, and made duck boards to go in there to raise it off. And
did you go in there very often?
Yeah. So then I covered the front over, because there was no frontage. It was just a hole, wasn't it? Like a door to go in with a ski patch at the back. There were six nuts on in a spanner that you could take the. If you got trapped in the front, you could take the plate off of the back and get out. So I made a sort of a covering at the front as well, and party us up on that. And we used to grow pumpkins up over there in the.
What was it like when you went in it? You'd spend a night in there.
I just slept in there. So anyway, the.
What was it like, Will?
I used to sleep down. My father was on one shift, I was on another. So it was a bit convenient that way, because we weren't. My sister was there. My grandfather had come to live with us as well in 1940, when his wife died, because he lived at Windmill Hill, so he came. But we used to sleep down there when the Blitz, you know, this air raids.
What were the air raids like?
Well, it was quite. Well, I could tell you, so I'm saying, can I go back to working on shift work with the air raids?
Yeah,
I was on shift work when the air raids, and if you should get a lot of planes flying over, going to. In the summer, the Blitz then started in Bristol in the summer, but used to get the planes flying over, going to, I don't know, it was, and used to drop a few odd bombs and things like that. And when I was on shift work, as boys, when the sirens went, we had to go to the shelter, which was across, so that was quite handy. We used to go over there and sit there and play cards, us wet and boys, see, lovely. The only thing is, under the air raid shelter was there, and over the top, they had all the loose coal stacked up for the boiler house, because they used to make their own. Generate their own electricity. But anyway, they decided that wasn't good enough, so we had to work. They stopped that. It was us, the machine would say, well, he's bloody over there, sat down drinking tea and playing cards, and I'm doing. So they stopped and we had to work. So they built little stone or brick built airway shelters, like a little blockhouse, about 6 foot square with little slits in, like a blockhouse. They used to have a lookout man on the roof, and he used to say, enemy aircraft approaching, take cover. So you stand in there and watch the machine. If anything happened on the machine then, no matter about the area, you got to come out and put it right. So, but you could stand there and watch it. So then if their blitz started, used to be a chief superintendent in charge of the mill.